A word to the wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week, that would be through the end of part one of The Last Argument of Kings by Joe Abercrombie. Hey there, this is Cross.
And I am a very fizzy PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
Crossland made two different cocktails, both fizzes, and I made one kind of absurd cocktail, also a fizz. So you guys are in for a treat today, I think.
They are some fizzy lads, and I'm excited to talk about them. I also included a sort of like matching hot sauce garnish on each of them based on the beer type and what I thought would fit the profile. So it's very exciting. And it was the right call as well.
All right.
It was so good. So cool. I'm very excited to talk today. It's our fifth episode talking about The Last Argument of Kings by Joe Abercrombie. This week, we're reading The Perfect Couple through Rude Awakenings. I am very excited to talk about this. This is kind of like the almost halfway point of the book for the most part. So we are rocking and rolling, cruising and a-bruising through this guy today. Shorter episode, just a couple of chapters. But PJ, give us that quick overview.
That quick overview. Duvall. Jesus. All right. That's a good hit. Strong start.
Yeah. Good move. Strong start. Duvall, our guy.
Our guy, Duvall. Giselle falls into a wedding with Princess Therese, a night ending with the wrong sort of attention paid to his fruits. Glockta spends Giselle's wedding day with Artie, doing his best to make light of the entire affair. Later, he's accosted by Malthus, who implores him on behalf of his employers to cease his investigation on Carmi Dan Roth and the supposed connection between Giselle and all that shit. But you know what I'm talking about.
Guslav, yeah.
Kingly duties and being the natural...
Being in charge and stuff.
Logan fights hard in his battle with Bethod's forces, but when the Bloody Nine comes out, everything else looks like child's play. After the funeral of Tolduru, Logan does a bit of introspection on whether it's possible to change who you are without completely abandoning everything associated with who you used to be. And West leads the Union Army to a tardy rendezvous with their Northmen friends, finishing off Bethod's forces with a few notable targets missing from the prisons and corpse piles. And finally, Pharaoh is reunited with Yulwe, who is bringing news of the Gurkish invasion to Baez, warning that they're coming for him specifically.
Cool. Good little summary. Summary dap dibble there. It's the end of part one. I would love to hear sort of your feelings, maybe on the whole, for this part of the novel so far, in addition to what we read this week. Like, you know, how you feeling?
I feel like all I want to talk about is how sad I am that Tolduru is in the ground.
Aww.
It is all consuming. So pissed,
PJ,
is what I'm feeling, Crossland. Pissed is how I feel about this entire part of the book.
Yeah. Yeah, pour one out for Tolduru Thunderhead. Cheers.
Cheers. We'll do it again later. There's another...
added a little bit of...
what's his fuck that's also dead, but, you know.
Yeah, true. What's his fuck? You mean Caspa?
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah, I don't know the guy that we always forget. It was very funny. This week for everyone listening at home, holy shit, I put some hot sauce in there. In that shot of vodka, because I was like, I wanted to just kick a little bit, kick back, fight back. Hmm. And it got me. It caught me unawares. No, but there's a moment this last week where you texted me, I think it was maybe your first time reading it, where you went, Tolduru, no! Also, that guy we never remembered his name of, no! And I laughed very hard when I read that text message. It was great. Hmm. So, yeah, I cannot wait to talk about what we've got going on this week. The cocktails, the beers, everything that's involved. So let's get started. We'll get right into it.
Let's do it.
All right, for our breakdown, we start with the perfect couple. We start off this week with another fitting, and it's fitting that Jizal is reflecting that he has become even more powerless in his new position than in the one that he occupied before as a soldier. He internally reflects, since his enthronement, he had drifted helplessly through one incomprehensible event after another, like a man shipwrecked and struggling to keep his head above water, out of sight of land, dragged who knew where by unseen, irresistible currents, but considerably better dressed.
Yeah, there are some positives that he points out, but like he doesn't seem to truly enjoy the spot that he's in as much as he did before, but there's some parallels, and specifically, I can't help but think about his musing on how you don't need to do much of anything if you've got somebody competent both in front of and behind you, or like above you and below you. Mm-hmm. And that kind of seems to be the position he's in now again.
Yeah. Yeah. He is lost adrift, just like he was before, but even worse in a lot of different ways. You know, it's funny. One of the things that I was reflecting on, obviously, I think about all of our guests and like what's going on. But I loved when we kind of got into the thesis of the first law in some degree with and chatted about sort of the like never changing. And you're like, well, Jizal's OK. And I was like, yeah, Jizal's OK. Silently backing you up, being like, he's not going to be, though.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the allyship in the moment.
Yeah. I tried. I tried to give you the benefit and also not spoil you too hard on it.
I wasn't wrong in the moment.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's just in the long run, you know, he's regressed as well. In addition to being forced into unfortunate circumstances, he's regressed a little bit. So,
yeah.
Tough. From there, we move to Artie and Glockta, of whom conclude that they must attend the wedding. Artie has a lot of just perfect lines this section that I adore, including the, like, it's noon, you know, of course I'm drunk or whatever. Like, there's so many good ones that come, especially right at the end of this first segment that we get with them. She says, having fucked the groom is really no excuse for missing a wedding, you know? And it's just, oh,
I think
primo,
it's a pretty good excuse.
Primo shit.
I think it's perfectly fine.
I think it's a perfectly acceptable excuse to miss the wedding.
Yeah.
Especially if you're still actively in love with him. Probably not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But throughout all of this, she's got some zingers, she's got some great lines, obviously, but I appreciate that Glockta is really trying hard to make her feel a little bit better through this entire scene. Like, he's catering to her in every way that he can think of, you know?
Yeah, especially early on. And he does recognize, I think, a little bit later that it's like it's just better to leave her in her misery to some degree, because like you can't solve everyone's problems. But at the same time, you know, you can't solve it without taking it on twice as hard for yourself, I think is a pretty close paraphrasing of what he says a little bit later. But
yeah,
he's doing his best for sure. So we then meet once again face to face with the extravagance of Talons as Duke Orso's Styrian ship docks with him absent. And I love the description of the dockyard here for the record. It gets really big and boisterous, and there's so much intricate detail about the inner workings of the ship. It lends to the sense of distraction, I think, that Jizal is kind of seeking solace in the moment before his beautiful soon-to-be wife awaits him as Jizal falls back in love with a thing he'd previously described as sickly and unsightly, the form of the modern noblewoman.
You remember that meme of Artie and Therese that I made of the two dogs?
Yeah, I know. I was super happy with that. I was so excited.
Every time he describes her as beautiful, that's all I think of. We're going to have to repost it now. Yeah.
PJ, when you made that meme, my heart sang, because I was like, the bitter irony of this is going to be so incredible.
it's so good.
A couple of months.
There are a couple other points not related to Therese specifically, related to the giant fucking warship that gets sent here and the absence of the Duke. Starting with the absence, there's something fucking nefarious going on here in my mind. Like, there. I don't understand why he's not there, but it doesn't make sense to me. Like, if there's a prior commitment, I feel like they would have just moved the wedding. I don't know.
Something must be going on in Mysteria.
Well, no, I think something is happening to the Union.
Oh.
I think this is not a good sign for them. Don't know what yet. I don't know. But I did love the description of the ship and the likeness or the comparison to Logan in a dress or whatever it was, like this dressed up warship being prettied up just makes it look more menacing.
Right. In a lot of ways, it's just its intimidation doesn't change.
Mm-hmm, yeah, exactly.
There's also this brief conversation that they have when they do finally meet and kind of exchange pleasantries about their marriage here as well. And Princess Therese says it's her duty to obey her as a daughter of like a nation, basically. Yeah. And that's just like, ooh, nice.
Exchanging pleasantries almost feels like too much of a, like, that almost gives this response too much credence.
Well, yeah, to Giselle, it's definitely pleasantries. Like, he views it as a pleasantry. And she kind of doesn't frame it too abjectly. Like, it's very affluently off-putting, I would say. And, like, it gets so much worse later, of course. Right. And the context only blooms from here. So, we then return from that moment to Glockta and Artie at the Lord's Round, and there's a fun little exchange between the two of them, the cripple using the drunk for support and all, especially as the banter furthers itself as a comparison between the pair of them and the king, the new king and queen. But Artie's pain in this moment is just super tangible and real to both us and Glockta, kind of like you were saying, in that misery as, like, the crowd cheers and jeers in the, like, foreground background. It's a tough one to watch. It reminds me of some of the better scenes of the early seasons of Game of Thrones when you had like Joffrey and sort of the various marriages and people cheering in the while people in the pavilion were depressed and afraid for their lives.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a great point to bring up, because I can't help but think how cinematic these interjections all feel.
Mm-hmm.
It feels very obviously written to be adapted. Again, like we talk about it all the time, so it feels overly repetitive to keep bringing it up sometimes. But this is a point where I like genuinely, that's all I was thinking about.
Fair point. And again, it just lends itself to sort of his style, right? Like in a lot of ways, as we move between different angles in the wedding and seeing different approaches, like seeing in some way, like Giselle through Artie's eyes or lens, you know, is just like a lovely little salve on top of the rest. Actually, it's the opposite of a salve. It's a irritant of sorts.
Little bit. A lot of bit.
A lot of bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
I really love Giselle's sort of confusion on his own wedding day. He asks the questions like, who is this for, in a lot of different ways, and kind of keeps phrasing of like, you know, is this a wedding for me? It seems to be for the people. You know, there's all of this, these sort of like small things. To break the tension between him and Therese, he actually steps out and decides to do a dance. And Giselle quickly realizes, like every duel he's experienced in any of this trilogy of novels, he's completely outmatched and outclassed. She receives rapturous applause for her performance, and Giselle is a bit hot and flustered about it all.
Quite a bit. Yeah. What do you think's better? Giselle the outmatched or Giselle the flustered? As far as like a kingly nickname goes.
Oh, man. Giselle the flustered, right? Because he's like kind of angry, but then he levels out a lot of the time. Like that fits more situations, yeah, I think.
That works.
Yeah. Yeah. But I see where you're going with. Outmatched, though, too. For sure. Functions. Yeah. And how like elegant Therese is in all these moments, and how, especially given, you know, knowing what you know, when you get to the end, it's like, oh God, she is just, this is full dog and pony show. Like this is, yeah.
Yep.
Awful. So from there, Glockta returns home and reflects again on who he serves, bow down before, and why he does what he does. He has this little bit where he says, what is it that I did to deserve this? And what is it that Luthar did? Is he not just as I was, arrogant, vain, selfish as hell? Is he a better man? Then why has life punished me so harshly and rewarded him so richly? The same reason that innocent Septan Teufel languishes in Angland with his fingers shortened. The same reason that loyal General Visbrook died in Dagoska, while treacherous Magister Ida was let live. The reason Tolkis, the Gurkish ambassador, was butchered in front of a howling crowd for a crime he did not commit. It is because life is not fair.
All right. Ignoring the fact that he was the direct reason for all of those.
Right.
Unilaterally, yeah. That was his choice.
Right. He leaned in. That was his responsibility and fault.
But I'm loving the sad, aggressively angsty Glockta. It's him. He's brooding.
It's who he is.
Yeah, but this is turned up a notch compared to what he's usually, what we're usually exposed to, at least.
And it is, not only is it turned up a notch, but it is like, it is the most reflective, genuinely, I think he's been on his own state in a long time, that is encompassing of his ego. A lot of the time, he's sort of like, woe is me in my situation, if that makes sense. This time, he's actually analyzing, like, how did I get here, really? Like, trying to get to the heart of the difference between him and someone else as he measures his life versus someone else's. Hell of a thing.
Hell of a thing.
Dude, this cocktail is so good. I am so excited to talk about it. My God. Okay, so to end this chapter, we've got a little bit to talk about, of course, moving on from that moment. Giselle is happy and hopeful post his wedding night, not seen since, you know, early in the morning. He expected this whole thing to be sort of a dour affair, an unfortunate affair, kind of forced into this wedding to begin with, whether or not he wanted to or not. Kind of surprised by his own wedding, kind of like you were saying last week, but he's happy and hopeful with his wedding completed. He's heading towards the bedroom with his bride, but that trip does not end as is expected, as Giselle attempts to bed in a more romantic flourish of sorts and is met with violence as he has misread this entire intent of their marriage. And not only the intent, but he's met with a new sort of puritanical nepo bigotism, which, because Giselle is a bastard compared to her previous betrothment. I don't know. This whole scene is brutal.
Fuck. Yeah. And like, I can't remember if these comments were in this same scene or leading up to this scene, but she talks about us highborns, excluding Giselle from that like designation pretty directly.
That's in this moment.
I think that's in this moment. Yeah. Man, what a tough situation to be in, and a bitter pill to swallow by Giselle.
Mm-hmm.
Taste of his own medicine to a certain extent, though.
You son of a fucking whore. How dare you touch me? Ladislaw was a cretin, but at least his blood was clean.
Yeah.
You know, like dude, no.
Yeah.
That's the one that gets me.
Yep. That's a heavy one. But then he gets his balls kicked in or kneed in or whatever.
Right.
Oh, sorry, man. I do wonder. I don't think anything would have changed, truly. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if he had like held off on talking to Artie until after this, if things wouldn't have been so unfixable between them. Wouldn't be so broken between them. I still think it would have ended with, what do you want me to be, your whore? But at least he'd have the framework of, this is a purely loveless political marriage for the strength of the union itself. It has nothing to do with my personal relationships, which I would want to extend towards you. Like, it still wouldn't have ended, I think, differently, but I think it would have maybe allowed some more space for them to not be so fractured.
It would have been, for the record, I understand exactly what you're saying as far as the approach, but that is like the approach of having his cake and eating it too.
It is. It is. You know? Totally. Like, but at least that's rationale.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely get that. I don't think that that's likely. Like you said, I don't think it's likely to have led to a different outcome. And if anything, I think that would, in my opinion, I think that that would actually be worse for Jizzal from a personality and character standpoint. Yes, there's like an absolute understanding, but with that understanding comes like a lack of, I don't know, I just view that personally as like a little bit worse, like, oh, okay, so this is what that is, so I need to treat you this way, and like, it just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel gross about the second one more than I do about the first one, in all honesty, because like, there's an honest truth to the pitch there, versus this would be like more like a dishonest selling down the river, or selling up the river a little bit more. You know, the love is more pure, if that makes sense. Like, but he is positioning as opposed to like coming at it from a position, coming at it with his best foot forward, even though he absolutely butchered it and didn't do a good job with any of it.
There wasn't a way to do a good job, though.
Well, he could have done a slightly better job than his sort of confused.
Better, but like, she understood.
Yeah, it wouldn't have changed anything.
What he was saying.
Yeah,
and it would still have been a hard no.
Right, right. The line would have been the exact same, but it would have been like a different pitch. I don't know. I personally, the deep irony that I find in this situation, I appreciate that, Reed, is this sort of. There's always been this caste system sort of underneath the thin veneer of this series. Like, it's not explored obliquely a lot of the time. It's really just used from Jizzal's perspective. But to have Therese wield it back in Jizzal's face just feels like the ultimate fuck you for who he was before, the ultimate comeuppance of all. I really dig it. Big fan. All right. With that, we move into our depressing, sad, unfortunate chapter. I do think we need to take a drink for the happy couple. And for the sad couple. So, cheers.
Cheers.
Did you already finish your fizz?
No. It's over here.
Okay. You were just taking some of the darkness. And I was like, what?
Yep.
I'm like terrified of mine separating. So I keep like kind of quasi stirring it and moving my stir stick back and forth. Although, in all honesty, this is staying together better than it generally does, which is interesting as well. Versus with club soda. So, I wonder if it's a density thing.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Maybe.
Could be the half and half versus whole milk, which is generally what I use too. So, or whipping cream, you know, whatever. Yeah. Heavy whipping cream. But I don't know. Anyway, moving
on.
The seventh day, our next chapter here. And here we go, man. A wild time for a battle as we start in Dogman's perspective, and he contemplates what the seventh day will bring, given the constant battle they faced with each of the various segments of Bethod's forces over the past days. We've had, of course, like the people coming over the Krinner, the Easterners. We've had the Shanka, of course, coming over and attacking. There's been all these different groups. There's contemplation on what's going to happen next and by whom.
Yeah. Is it here? I think it's here that they mention that it's been like, 4 days since the Flatheads.
I think it's in Logan's perspective, but it is like right here.
Yeah.
In this section
when they're talking about what's coming.
It's early on. It's before the battle starts.
Yeah. That didn't catch my attention at all on my first read, but definitely does after a couple reads based on just like a footnote with Wes later on.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a vibe. Well, a lot of people made it out.
Like 5,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So where the fuck were they?
Good question.
Weird.
Uh-oh.
Oh,
what do I do?
What's going on?
I'm in trouble. There's also this small moment tucked inside of this as the sort of section ends from Dogman's perspective and cuts over to Logan's, where Tull Duru Thunderhead tries his hand at a joke and it totally lands completely flat, and that is... so sad for the last joke from our guy.
The last joke is a bad one. I don't even remember what the joke was off the top of my head.
Yeah, I don't. I literally reread this just minutes before we started because I was freshening myself up. Oh, he asks if he can change his mind about whether or not he thinks the plan is a good idea 7 days in waiting for the union, which is, it's pretty good.
It is pretty good.
Yeah.
No response, though. No feedback. That's a pretty good one.
Yeah. Bummer, dude. So we move from there to Logan, and the man is sore and beaten from his time over the last week. You know, what he's experienced over these 7 days. There's a soldier of whom has lost a finger. One of, I believe, Shiver's boys of whom has lost a finger. And asks about if the feeling of a missing finger ever goes away. And he kind of lies that it does in time, which is interesting because he still goes for it and feels it. Like, there's an honesty there, but at the same time, there's a dishonesty of like, yeah, it just goes away. Don't worry about it.
I took it as he was talking about like the actual phantom pain, like the phantom feel, like feeling. Whereas Logan,
yeah, the phantom limb,
it's more right. of like a habitual tick to mm-hmm. feel that space and feel the nub. I don't think he still feels the appendage. I don't think he still feels
no, but it's
in his like nervous system.
No, right. It's the phantom limb syndrome, right? Like it's totally like just what that is. And so I think that he's saying. He's lying a little bit, or lying by omission, maybe is a better way to put it, by like not explaining it and just like kind of nodding and saying, yes, it does, because he's got other things to worry about. Like, I don't think that this is also a malicious lie. I think that it just shows how far Logan's been stretched, more or less.
And I think he's not trying to get into a deeper philosophical conversation with the guy like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's a more drawn out explanation of what he's gone through than.
Right. And that's
the guy's asking about phantom pain.
Yeah.
Pretty clearly.
And I
thought at least.
Well, yes. But I think that he was also generally saying, like, does this feeling go away? And the answer is just no, not really. But even though he says, yes, it does. But like it numbs really is sort of his takeaway. Like you become numb to it. It doesn't go away. It just, especially compared to like the way that he's massaged, like the area, like you're saying, or the zone, like over the course of the last couple of books, it's one of those small things that stands out to me from Logan's perspective that shows that when worn down, he kind of does. I mean, like anyone, he does kind of change and revert. And shortly thereafter, this is just further kind of proven or is drawn to its most logical conclusion as Krummick kind of breaks Logan by just talking to him, as Logan gives him the what's for of what he's sick of and every single ounce of who he is and what's going on, you know?
Yeah, this is what pointed out to me how high the tensions were, because I mean, obviously we haven't been exposed to them in the last few days, and we really only got a little bit here and there of the entire last week. Like we got the major beats, but we didn't get like their downtime and how much Krummick actually talks. So I don't know how actually sick of Krummick Logan was, but this felt like a wild, like over the top reaction. Like Logan never seemed to be that grated upon by Krummick. Like he was uncomfortable about some of the conversations that Krummick had with his kids about Logan, but like that was kind of where the discomfort seemed to stop in the past. So this was, even for Logan, felt like an over the top reaction.
Yeah. And I think that's, again, speaks to the exasperation of the days of warfare, right? It also, you know, to me, points to Logan's like will wearing thin, and that's why the Bloody Nine comes out a little bit later too. Like this is all one in the same in some regard as to Logan's wear and tear and what kind of position that puts him in. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that tensions are high and there's a lot of pressure and stress, and as such, you know, when's the Bloody Nine show up? When pressure's high?
Sometime.
Yeah, he'll show up in a minute, and we're going to be real sad about it
a little bit.
Yeah. So pages. Facing down the day and what's to come in the morning, he realizes through a brief chat with Black Dow that it's likely time for the Carls to come, as they've fought in every other bastard who they could possibly send. The sky is clear. There's no rain. There's nothing else that's going to take them down a notch, and that the Carls are going to show up and end this. Logan takes a beat after this sort of mutual conversation with Dow, in which they seem on a level playing field for the first time since we've seen them interact, since they've re-met each other here. And Logan yearns for those simpler days before with Malekith, Pharaoh, and Jizal on the plane. And that's just kind of a nice little heart moment of wishing that he could have gone back. Mm-hmm. He has this happening a little bit later where he says something to the extent of like, coming up north for fucking vengeance. Why did I do this? And, you know, he just very much regrets this line of decision making.
It really makes me want to see in the past the headspace of Logan before a battle. If it's anything different, if it's more like Tull, where he's like amped up and ready and like fucking love the woods. Like last time.
Yeah.
Or if he's like wishing he hadn't left his wife and kids to come fight. Like, if there's another sort of wanting to go back to something different, but something all the same. I'd just be curious. I don't know for sure if there's a prequel short story or something, but I can't remember if we've talked about that in the past. I know there are a bunch of short stories. I can't remember what they cover.
I can tell you that there will be at least one Logan prequel short story. There is only one Logan prequel short story. There's not just at least one. There just is one.
There is.
But all right. There's also a Glockta one. I think those are the only prequel short stories, if I recall correctly. Everything else is kind of in between the stories, but
gotcha.
In between book 6 and book 7, for the record. But oh no, there's one other story that is kind of a mid-series story. But we'll get there when we get there.
We'll get there when we get there.
Oh man, I understand exactly where you're coming from, though, like kind of wanting to get a vibe for where Logan is in battle, because all of the times that we've conventionally seen him haven't been a conventional war, right? Like, it hasn't been like this type of thing. So we don't know sort of what his mindset is, and we don't have a level playing field with which to view this moment in a lot of cases. The only thing we can do is compare him to as we know him in the moment. And that's where there's sort of this mislevel of sort of our expectations versus who he is and what he presents.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
He's the old Bloody Nine. Terrifying as ever.
Yep.
Woo! We then enter just an excellent battle sequence that I can't even begin to like go into detail on. I know that lately we've been like shortcutting like battles and like cool things. There are some moments in here that I would love to talk about, and if there's anything that you like, you know, call it out. But I am like actively right now, one of the projects that I'm working on in the background is figuring out how to talk about battles specifically for the heroes, because it is such a big deal that like we have to have a way to talk about it. So I'm working out a format right now to get a little bit more clear on some of these different moments. But this is just so excellent. There's this whole thing kind of becoming hell as we're in Dogman's perspective, and these arrows rain down in the tower, and there's this wonderful line again that sort of ends that, his perspective before it flips over, becomes time for each man to choose where he die. Like, there is brutal revelations throughout.
It's great. This is such fucking chaos. I'm trying to think.
You can see where Pierce wrote Dark Age, right? Like, you can see where this like segment comes from, the chaos of like that bit to here.
Yeah, yeah. I specifically was about to say, I can't recall which battle it is in Dark Age, but it is.
The Battle of Uladon, right? Like that 130-page segment where they're like fighting over the sand.
Yeah, but even then, I feel like there are specific sections in there that this one pretty clearly lines up with one that I have in my head, and I just can't remember what it is.
It reminds me of when Darrow, and I will keep this as spoiler free as possible, when Darrow is at his wit's end, and he's kind of like, he's crashing, he takes the stims, and there's that whole thing on the city battlements and stuff like that.
That's what it is.
That's the one that it reminds me of, at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the same.
Yeah, there's another thing that like I don't have in the notes, but that I absolutely love, is the way that the crush is described near the gate as sort of the battering ram comes, and there's this sort of squeezing, the inability to reach around people, the sort of, you know, picking up whatever weapon and just swinging at whoever you can. And this is before Logan becomes the Bloody Nine, you know, just assuming you're hitting the right people. And like
you just have to do that in order to not fucking die. You know,
yeah, man, like, it is.
Oh man, it did feel a little like a mosh pit.
Very much, yeah. It did. It like, did. It does have. Reminded me. You know, come to think of it,
that man, was it the first Riot Fest that we went to that had the lake in the middle, Douglas Park?
Yes, that was not Douglas. That was the other park.
No, the second one, Humboldt Park.
Yeah, Humboldt. Yep.
where Senses Fail played like on that far one that we had to walk down the lake. That was like the craziest mosh pit I've ever been in. I got into like an actual fight with a guy, like like an actual like mosh pit, like one-on-one competition with the dude. It reminded me of that.
There is this sort of like crush, there's this smashing, there's this like deep elbowing, and this is also the moment in which this movie this book feels distinctly like a Kurosawa movie, right? On the front of each of these, or on the front of a couple, it's like George R. R. Martin directed by Akira Kurosawa or something, Lord of the Rings directed by Akira Kurosawa, I believe is the description. And this chapter is, to me, where that feels the most accurate. This is a bloody moment. There's a lot of intensity. There's high pressure and stress. And when we get into the Bloody Nine's perspective, and there's this sort of poetry to carnage, that's when it becomes and feels the most like Ran or like Yojimbo at its highest moments, and all of these other sort of like oeuvre of movies that just like gush and ooze blood, gore, violence originally. So.
I know it won't matter for you, but if for some reason this comes out as a movie, I want it in black and white.
You know, they say this battle happens during the daytime, but I want it so badly to happen during the nighttime. And I'll tell you why in particular. I want it to be dark and with like just a little bit of thunder on the edges. And the reason I say that is because I think that that adds to the sort of mystique of the Bloody Nine a little bit. And it also adds to the, did he kill Tulduru a little bit later? Because no one could clearly see.
Yeah, but I feel like everybody around them dies anyway.
Sure, fair enough.
And I feel like they talk specifically about that. Like, battles happen in the day.
And a lot of battles happen during the day. I'm not saying, I'm just saying like it starts in the day and maybe it goes, right? Yeah, and then it like becomes night. Fair.
Okay.
Because like, you know, like, and then it starts to like happen over the course.
Yeah.
Because I think that that is the way
it would be progress. More dramatic for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because which is why that you gives, see battles depicted at night.
Yeah. Oh, it's entirely for the drama. And in addition, you can kind of make things feel more claustrophobic when it's not light. This is something we talked about, is this something we talked about? Because that was episode 4 of House of the Dragon. I don't think we've recorded it. I think we talked around it. We talked about it offline. But part of the reason that House of the Dragon episode 4 is so good is because it's a daytime battle and the way that it was shot and like a lot of the sort of scope and scale of it. Anyway, join our Patreon. We haven't recorded that episode yet, but we'll be there. We promise.
It'll be there. We're just
soon, TM. We're very behind. But you know what? We don't have to travel as much in the near future, so we can catch up. It's basically what we're doing. So after a bit, did you have anything else in sort of the main crush of the battle before we get into the anything else?
No, I think that covers it.
Cool. So after a bit more of the battle, we cut to Wes and Polder looking out over the battle as it's happening and Wes making a decision of what is to be done given their present circumstances. Wes calls for a charge, a risky move versus safely deploying the infantry, but a more timely one in a lot of fashions as is necessary to support the Northmen allies to ensure that his friends don't die down there. And he reflects on the three heroes in his own mind from the past. I love this reflection of like the failure of boldness a lot of the times and him falling into the same sort of pattern and like not realizing the mistake of people in the past, but understanding why they might make the decision and why he's making it for a different reason than they would have made those decisions. That's what this reflection means to me in its core is sort of the difference between him and these three men that he's kind of calling out here. So he says, Colonel Glockta would have no doubt have grinned at the prospect of such a deadly gamble. Prince Ladislav would have approved of such a cavalier carelessness with other men's lives. Lord Smund would have slapped backs and talked of vim and vigor and called for wine. What is it? It's capital. Yes.
I get where you're coming from, and I think the Glockta call out makes sense, but it's such a sad sack of heroes that he's calling upon in his mind, and he doesn't even mention Burr, who has he does later.
No, I'm agreeing with you, PJ. I'm saying he is calling them out negatively. He's saying like, I am falling in line with people that I think fucked up. I'm making a call that I've seen go badly. He's like aligning himself incorrectly with those people, maligning his own choice, I think.
Yeah,
because he cares about his friends.
He very easily could have immediately drawn upon the accolades given to him by Burr, talking about the necessity of ruthlessness in battle,
right,
in a leader. Have been a really easy way to like tie it in and excuse it and give reason for it. But it felt weird that he didn't. I understand the point. I get it. But it seems odd to me that he didn't even like bring up Burr in this.
I think it doesn't. And let me just maybe give you a little something different than what I've already mentioned. West is really down on himself as an individual, as a person, as a leader. Yeah. And so he is immediately drawing a negative comparison because he views himself as bad at what he does. And he always has viewed himself as bad in the role. Like, he makes bad decisions. He has made a lot of bad decisions over the course of the novel, but he does make the ruthless choice, which is what Burr would have encouraged, and it works, and it's effective and it's successful in the end. I mean, obviously I'm kind of skipping to the conclusion here a little bit, but that said, like, he's drawing the comparison in his mind to all these failures that he's known. In reality, he's much more successful than any of those people ever were. But often grappling with, you know, self-doubt, you know, that sort of, those are the demons that you stare down, are the people that you've seen either fail before or try before, and not the people that you've seen be successful or otherwise. So he's got like a good, despite everything else, he's got like a level ego, which I think is more than a lot of our characters can say.
Yeah, that's fair.
I really appreciate West's perspective. I almost said I love West's perspective. I love West's perspective. West is awful, but I love West's perspective.
Yeah, it is a good perspective. Very much so.
So from there, we move back to Logan fighting in close quarters down by the gate, as we'd mentioned. He gets knocked over. He's exasperated. He's out of breath. And Tull Duru Thunderhead comes looming in, having left Dogman to help him pick him back up and bring him back into the fight. He grabs a knife close to his chest, a good knife, and he sinks it right into the man's neck. The blood pours over him in gaping gushes, a bloody fountain of sorts that paints his whole face red, his beard, his body, just red in this man's blood, as he becomes the Bloody Nine. Because to touch the Bloody Nine was to touch death, and death has no favorite, makes no exceptions. And after a righteously sad bout of violence, as the Bloody Nine tears through people, as this sort of extra possession of death scratched by their weapons as they swing at him, he gets to work. He kills everyone in his path. He cleaves through shoulders. He gets around shields. This is where, More than anything else that I've said before, this is where it becomes an Akira Kurosawa movie in which people turn into gouts of blood very simply by a sword slash, which is very cool in those movies. It's also very cool when depicted here with the Maker's Blade, of whom literally cuts through any material. It doesn't need to be sharpened. So sick. So great. There are daggers. There's all kinds of things. He pulls out all kinds of stuff. Yeah, it is nothing short of excellent. It's a true berserker rage I've never seen depicted in fiction in a similar fashion up until my reading of this character, and in particular, I think, this moment.
Yeah, fuck, man. I almost didn't get a chance to mourn Tull Duru because of just how fluidly it goes from the murder of his friend to just making mincemeat of everything. It's so fast. It's so intense. I love that line, to touch the Bloody Nine was to touch death. Brutal. Fucking brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been bad. It's been good, it's been bad, and it's been real bad during this moment. So it's especially awful because Tull Duru's last words, and we'll drink for Tull in a moment here, he says, "It's all right, I've got you." As like Logan is trying to warn him away as he hits the ground and he's exasperated and can feel himself being taken over, because he says "get" and he can't warn him about what's to come fully. Ugh, man, I also love this sort of, it's so interesting because Joe is a very simple writer for the most part. He approaches prose very simply and elegantly. Minimal sentences, proper adjectives, not a whole lot in the way of adverbs. It's well written. And he has this way, though, when he flows into the Bloody Nine, where that shifts a little bit. So one little section that I really like here. The Bloody Nine rose up, shoving the great corpse away from him, and his red fist closed tight around the giant sword, a heavy length of star-bright metal, dark and beautiful, a righteous tool for the work that awaited him. So much work. And it's just like, oh, God, here he goes. Yeah,
it's so good. So much work.
This is that. So much work. This is that cover of the Curious King version of the book with like his face just like painted in blood with like the eyes almost glazed over white that I adore so much. And, like, absolutely reminiscent of this in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he also thinks of everyone around him as the dead, like the faces of the dead shifted and blurred around him, roaring and bellowing their angry chorus or whatever. And it's just like, oh, dude, like, whoa.
Yeah.
They're going to die. They're going to die shortly.
And they do. He is right. He is death.
Yeah. He is, you know. Everyone cowers, they fail, laughed at the fear, teeth bared, smiling, cleaved through shoulders. In the end, the Carls retreat as the Unimans clearly have charged through, and the sound of victory rings loudly out as Logan takes back some semblance of control as everyone has come to realize who this is, and someone says, "You are forgiven," and he says, "Forgiven," before he comes back down and calms himself out of the rage.
I thought the "you are forgiven" moment was when the guy like drops his weapon and then drops his sword and goes and throttles him.
Right. So he says that, but then he again whispers "forgiven" to himself.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not fully. So he says like "you are forgiven," squeezes his eyes in with his thumbs. And then he says he flung it away and it fell upon the mud and flopped over and over in a manner that greatly pleased him. And then he says like "forgiven" and kind of like falls back into himself. And that's sort of the line that takes him out.
Okay. Yeah.
So it is both like the final cry of the Bloody Nine in the battle and then also Logan kind of reclaiming himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's not holding his righteous tool anymore.
No, right. Yeah.
I don't think that's the source of the thing, though.
No, probably not. Probably not. It seems as though this existed long before, because people understood when it happened. They went nine fingers, the Bloody Nine, they gave him space. And when you give a man space to work, he's just going to make art out of your bodies. So, good victory, nonetheless.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else on the seventh day?
No. No. Great to see the Bloody Nine some more.
Yeah.
That's the longest. Always is. I feel like that's the longest we've lived with him.
For sure. It is the longest section. It's like 4 or 5 pages versus most of them are like a page and a half. All right, PJ. So it is time for us to get into our drink segment here. Let's go into the cocktails that we're having. We're both very excited to talk about them. PJ, what are you drinking?
You
want to
start with your first one? We'll go.
They're the same. Sandwich. But they're the same. They so are, it's kind of.
Okay, yeah.
I'll
yeah,
let
yeah.
you go.
Good point.
I'll let you
point,
go.
Good point.
Yeah.
And mine is almost the same as yours. I'm going with the name Tall Duru Thunder Fizz.
Yeah.
This is a celebration of drink things northern. So I wanted to do straight aquavit, but I only had an ounce of it, so I did 1 ounce of aquavit and 1 ounce of the End of Days barrel rested gin. Okay, let me back up. I approached this like a gin fizz, and mm-hmm. I think I replaced almost every ingredient with something else, except for the egg white and the simple syrup. So, 1 ounce of aquavit, 1 ounce of barrel rested gin. 1 ounce of burnt orange juice. So basically I took an orange and I sliced it in half and I literally just put it over the flames of my stove for a little while until it until the edges started like charring and like the whole face of it got caramelized. And then I hit it with a blowtorch a little bit more just to kind of juice it. So You do. I don't know if you do that with orange that often, but I feel like it worked really well. You do it more with lemon to kind of take that acid bite out of it. 3/4 of an ounce of simple syrup, 1 egg white, and then 1 milliliter of this chaga mushroom extract that I made. Basically, I soaked a bunch of dried chaga mushrooms in Everclear for like 6 months. And then
6 months?
6 months, yeah. And then
that's how you made that? I didn't realize. No, I'm so sorry. Anyway,
that was half of it. So then I took that liquid, I strained that liquid out, and then I took the excess chaga or the soaked chaga and I boiled it in water for like 4 hours. And then I mixed the two liquids together because different things come out of the mushroom in the different solvents, in water and in alcohol. And then I combined it and then I put it in a little dropper bottle. So I added a milliliter of that. I think I probably could have gone with a little bit more, which is why I put a few drops on top. But anyway, I took all that, I dry shook it, and then added ice and shook it and strained it into a glass. I thought it would just be a gross muddy brown, but I realized that it was going to be a lot more voluminous than what my like ceramic tiki mug could hold. Mm-hmm. So I did it in a glass mug just a Vieski glass.
Collins
glass. And added to that and then topped it off with Surly Darkness, which is their annual Russian Imperial Stout. This is the 2017 version, I think. Maybe 2016? Might be the 2016 version. I can't remember which came first, the Cerberus or the Baba Yaga. Anyway.
Cerberus and then Baba Yaga.
Okay, so this is 2017.
I'm almost positive.
Yeah. And then I added 3 more drops of the chaga extract onto the foam. This is so good. I expected it to be all right. I didn't expect it to be as good as it actually is. It is complex. It is dark in notes. That charred caramelized orange really comes through. It perfectly complements the darkness, like that mushroom and the aquavit, the herb forward notes on the aquavit. Like everything complements everything in this cocktail, and I'm really, really happy with it. So yeah, and when I the picture that I took for it, it was almost like the nitro sort of cascading effect. And it looked a lot prettier in person than it did in the picture. And then when it finally settled, it was just straight black with like white foam. But anyway, following that up is the
rest of that darkness.
Yeah.
PJ, we kind of blindly realized that we were doing the same thing when I called you to, like, when we called to talk about times and, like, when we were going to be able to, like, start today, where I was like, I think I'm going to do a Thunderhead fizz. And you were like, that's a great idea. I already was going to do it.
I had already put this in the fridge. Like, it was already the fridge and, like, chilled and ready to go when you told me that.
I bought specifically half and half for the occasion because I wanted to try like a lighter version in a lot of ways, because I've done a couple of different fizzes, like doing egg white and then like heavy cream, and I don't know, just like trying to get that mixed down.
This is probably a good point to talk about the two different types of gin fizzes, if you want to.
Yeah. So elaborate. PJ's gin fizz is an egg white gin fizz. The type of gin fizz that I made is generally called like a Ramos gin fizz. It's an older cream style, you might even say egg cream style fizz, that is based out of like the old soda fountains and sort of the stylings therein is the style that I did. PJ's is more sort of the new age cocktail fizz. Yeah.
I believe that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ramos is the older fizz. I do know that.
Yep.
So I made a spin on the Ramos gin fizz, of which I've had on the show before. I made a cocktail based on Orion previously. I think it was the last time I did this, way back in Dark Age.
Yeah, you used the Blue Raspberry Jones Soda.
Jones Soda, yeah. So that was the last time that I did a gin fizz, so it's been a long time. So I made 2 variants because I kind of spun it off, but the core ingredients read as such. So one is going to be called the Thunderhead's Delight, and the other one is the Bloody Nine's Victim. But the first is, regardless, the base recipe that I used here, I don't think this is right. I kind of just winged it. I was like, I'm pretty sure these are, like, this is the right amount of half and half. I think this is the right amount of spirits and lemon lime. It turned out perfectly. I recommend exactly what I did. 2 ounces of vodka, 1 ounce gin, 1 ounce of Saint Germain, an ounce of lemon juice, an ounce of Orgeot. That ounce of Saint Germain, by the way, I think is closer to 3/4. I free poured it. I kind of just eyeballed it and went bup and did it because I was like, oh shit, there's no complexity in this because that gin's pretty basic. So I threw in the Saint Germain to add a little something. It tastes incredible. Oh, 1 ounce of Orgeot, which is the other different spin that I did here. Generally, I think you do 1.5 ounces, but with the Saint Germain, I was like, that's going to be perfectly sweet and no need for additional sugar, but you might up the Orgeot just a little bit if you're not going with Saint Germain, if you went with like chartreuse or something else. 3 ounces of 1.5 ounces shaken. First, you dry shake to incorporate all the ingredients. Then you add ice cubes. You shake for 3 to 5 minutes. The longer you shake, the more foamy it gets. You don't need to shake that whole time. Just do it to the level that you kind of want to do. I served it in 2 different like short champagne flutes, basically to like get kind of the effect. I split this cocktail into 2 different glasses, serves 2, great. And then I used 2 different beers for the different floats. Generally speaking, you would add a club soda. Instead, I went with beer again, because it feels northern. It feels thunderheady. So the first that I did was a Southern Pines Carolina Clara Mexican style lager, just like a nice little local. Again, lager. I was like, this won't be bad. This will be inoffensive. The second beer that I did is called the Seneca Guns, which is from Leland Brewing Company. It's local. Again, very local to me. The Seneca Guns is sort of the sound that's generated by weird like plate tectonics that kind of sounds like a cannon firing, but nothing is firing. It's actually just the plates kind of rubbing against each other. It's a weird sound pocket thing. It may have started the Revolutionary War. No one's sure because they think that they heard cannon fire from a basin location and may have inadvertently caused some issues. So down in the South, at the very least, this started the Southern War, not the Northern War. Yeah. Really? So the two beers of the two, they're both incredible. I honestly feel bad picking one over the other. I preferred the Seneca Guns IPA slightly over the lager, but I would say the lager is really accessible for just about everyone. So I would recommend that for most people.
So I feel like that makes sense in this cocktail because of the sort of the bitterness, and I'm assuming the like fruity notes that are going to be added to that cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
I would agree,
it's going to be a lot more, I'm assuming, a lot more level with the lager.
Yes. Yeah. The lager is, that's what I'm finishing out right now. The lager is much more level. The other thing that I did is on top of the foam, each of them I added an accompanying hot sauce that over time got mixed into the rest of the cocktail. So there was a Verde, like Mexican-inspired hot sauce on the Mexican lager, of which incorporated incredibly, just 2 dashes. You'd use like green Tabasco, it'd taste about the same. Or, oh my God, Bravo Verde. It would be
which you
just awesome.
At my house.
I know! I'm so mad! You have no idea! I know!
It, yeah. I used it a couple days
That's
ago.
Good. You should definitely use it. Use it all.
I'll bring it to you at the wedding that you're coming to in a couple weeks.
Okay, all right. Or just bring me a burrito. We could get new burritos. No, but so that was great. The other one, I put a blueberry habanero hot sauce on top of, okay, which was also very good. So both of them were awesome. An Omnia hot sauce in both cases, so... Or not Omnia, Onima, yeah, Onima. Excellent hot sauces. Man, again, featured on Hot Ones.
Ilmig Plus is so fucking good.
It's like the perfect habanero hot sauce. There is no better habanero hot sauce.
So, you Minnesotan listeners, if you like Crybaby Craig's, you are going to love Ilmig Plus. It's like an amped up version of it. In both flavor and intensity.
Mm-hmm. Also, for anyone questioning what we're talking about, you can check it out on the most recent season of Hot Ones. It is featured in the later hot, I think it's in like the back 5 hot sauces.
I think it's number 6.
Okay. It's right when the heat amps up, I think, is like that's the turning point hot sauce or one of them. But yeah, again, a guy that my parents met in Spain, and they loved his hot sauces, and they bought as much as they could legally carry. And as he was selling, he sold them samples that were like not for sale for sure. Classic. Anyway, awesome. much appreciated. So yeah, I'm having to follow that up. I'm having those beers because I have 2 open beers. So
all right.
It's the nature of the beast.
Hell yeah.
All right, cool. Sweet. With that, we go into Too Many Masters. Getting back at it, we return to Glockta's perspective, and he's here to deal with and sort out where he stands with Malthus. After his summons, to which he finds that the superiors of the Bank of Valentin Balk are not happy at his continued investigations into the provenance of Jazal Dan Luthar, and whether or not he is the child of Carmidan Roth and Guslav V. He's left instead juggling the matter of whom he should bend the knee to here, as his masters are directly opposed against each other.
Yeah, I feel like this is the right way to word this. I'm still trying to figure out the motivations of the leadership of Valentin Balk. I'm not convinced that Malthus is not one of those voices of leadership.
Leaders.
Doing a good job of playing the lackey. Not convinced he's not also the actual leader. We'll see. But anyway, as far as this specific scenario goes, how this is presented, I wouldn't be terribly surprised if they don't actually care about Jazal's true parentage or anything about Dan Roth, but are rather testing. Like, they understand that Glockta is on an official task, and they want to test his loyalty and test how easily that loyalty to Sult can be broken. And basically making Glockta choose between them and Sult. It feels like a good candidate as a test.
Yeah, it does feel like a good candidate because he could investigate much worse. You know, like there are so many other things that he's much more competent in and could dive into in different ways. Yeah.
And also, it feels like no matter what Glockta uncovers, the machine of bureaucracy has moved forward. He has been coronated as king. I don't know if there's much they can even do to uncoronate him, to decrown him. I don't know if they can. I don't know if that exists as far as their bureaucratic system goes.
And that was kind of something that even Sult kind of talked about a little bit last week. He was and Glockta questioned it back at him of can we even do anything outside of kill him to defame him? The damage is kind of done. And that's kind of been something that they've been trying to unwind or wind forward either way. And there's no action. They're just looking for leverage.
So if this is an ultimately effectively useless task for Glockta, as far as outcomes go, perfect test from Valentin Balk. It still doesn't answer the question of how they know that he's doing this. Who's spying? Who's talking? I don't know. That's my
reading. Dig it. So the other ask that they have for him, I should say, is that he spy back on the Archlector and what is kind of going on over at the university, a more curious entanglement of these two sides, having their investigator basically pressed to investigate the other side, no matter what's kind of happening and the vested interests, they're being shut off from one angle, it's turn around and invest the other guy. It's a tough bind to be in, stuck in a road between two dentists, isn't it?
A little bit. I'm pretty glad that they're pushing him to investigate the university. I really want to know what's going on there.
Yeah. I totally get it. I've latched on in this reread into Glockta's presentation of the road between two dentists as he continually is stuck at a crossroads, generally between two parties for the entirety of every novel. Thus far. So I appreciate the sort of that analogy and the time that we spent on it in that chapter, because I think that it constantly comes back up. And right now, in particular, in Too Many Masters, it feels like he is truly caught between two unfortunate ends and kind of just has to figure out how to navigate that, if he can navigate it at all. All right. Fair enough. With that, we move on from Glockta and we move to Sweet Victory, which is more like a bittersweet victory in a lot of different ways. We'll get into that.
They fucking
won. They fucking won, dude. Fucking won. Okay? Yeah. I love the very first dialogue.
They actually accomplished.
Yeah, right. What actually, this is a bittersweet victory by all accounts. This is not
a bittersweet quote unquote victory.
Yeah, right. But to bring it back, the very first dialogue tag of this chapter I really, really like. There's, like you're saying, and like we've been kind of alluding to, there's this sort of somber "we won" from Pike that can be taken either way and intoned to mean just the same as "we lost" from West's perspective. And I think it's a solid reminder that we're trapped in this sort of bleak reality in which war, no matter which side you're on, has a price, and the price for victory is losses.
Yeah, it's a steep fucking price, especially this one. And it's not even fully realized at this point in the chapter. There's right. there's a lot more price to be paid, or that has been paid, that
we come to realize. Yeah.
West comes to realize as he walks through this battlefield.
I do want to bring up, just because I think it's relevant in the immediacy, that Polder comes off real strong among these pages in a positive way that I don't think he has for the entirety of his time in the book, in any of the books. Washing West in feels like genuine praise, as though he's like, not, I wouldn't say taking him under his wing, but like promoting him and like helping him, and genuinely thinks that he could be a good leader. And also brings up how proud he thinks Burr would have been in this moment of him.
I am incredibly torn about this. I want to believe that Polder is being genuine, but I know how far he's willing to stick his nose up somebody's ass.
Right.
You know, like we haven't seen this from Polder because we've been looking up at Polder. West hasn't been in charge of Polder until now. So we don't know what sort of man Polder was from Burr's perspective. I have a suspicion that this is what he looked like to Burr also.
Wait, that this is what Polder looked like to Burr? Oh, okay. That this is sort of the way that he is to a leader. Got it.
This is,
yeah, but Burr was
brown noser.
Yeah, fair. He's definitely brown nosing, but he's not like,
well, also Croy's not here.
I don't get brown nosing from this. I get genuine like success and praise. Like, this doesn't feel like the forced praise race that he was doing before. Yeah.
He's trying to not get dismissed and fired.
I think it's different. I don't think he's begging. Like, there's no part of this that's begging. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. All right.
There's probably at least a modicum of genuine like truth to what he's saying, but I think he's saying it so articulately because he knows it'll paint him in a good light.
Yeah. The first part, I guess, is kind of, or rather the second half, you know. Okay, maybe I do see it. I think I'm thinking of the back half of this, if that makes sense. Like, the front half, he's coming off kind of the same way, right? Like, he's like, no one could deny that you well and truly avenged the death of Vladislaw, which is deeply ironic, of course. There's the masterstroke of using the Northmen as a decoy. Well, that's not what I'm doing. You're just praising me randomly. Like, that is in your camp. It's after that that he's talking about, like, the prisoners and sort of how long they're going to be there, the Bloody Cross, sort of the back half of this is where it's deeps a little bit into something a little bit more genuine. But yeah, I do see what you're saying. I was not evaluating the first half and was instead letting the back half live with me a little bit more. He was sort of echoing a lot of the same commendations.
And maybe I'm letting the front half bleed into the back half a little bit more than it needs to. So it probably lies somewhere in between your take on it.
Right. Insulating his job and being genuine at the same time. Yeah. Yep. Of course, there's more to come as we account for the dead, and we find that Lieutenant Brint is holding a limp Lieutenant Caspa, his life stolen from him with a stray arrow, his sword never leading its holster, his scabbard this whole time. He's been playing cards. Poor Lieutenant Nobody.
Cheers to What's-His-Face.
Cheers to What's-His-Face.
Let's never forget him. Great man.
We'll never forget What's-His-Face. So sorry, Caspa, for forgetting you so often.
I don't care.
Still regularly. pour one out right on his grave, but make sure that it's there to erode his name on his gravestone. You're pouring it over his name.
Written
not on
graphic.
The grave.
What?
On the gravestone. Yeah. What? It's a sad scene to like walk up on, and then sort of West isn't indifferent. He's definitely sad. But it's one of those things that he knew the consequences of what he was doing, by and large. he didn't fully grapple with the friends that he was exchanging for the friends that he protected.
Right.
Fair to say?
I think that's a really, really acute read on how he reacts to this. Without him mentioning any of it, he's kind of in a weird funk as he's like leaving Brint holding Caspa.
Because he's mad at Brint for being sad. Like, yeah. Which is such a weird takeaway. But also,
I think it brings me back to who West is.
Yeah.
And his base default, like,
furious
mood. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I want to give Wes just a little bit more credit than what we're saying there and comparing him to Furious and whatnot and his moniker. I do think that it definitely applies. I do think that this frustration comes from him wanting everyone to understand the position that he was forced into to make this decision.
Yeah.
And that he's frustrated that Brint isn't on the same level already. At the same time, it isn't every soldier's responsibility to understand the duty of command at the highest level. So, like, that frustration is misplaced, which I think is what we're juggling here as an emotion.
Yeah. And I think probably where the wires got crossed a little bit is how quickly West rose. Because a few short months ago, they were more or less like one step apart from each other as far as command goes.
One or two. But like,
I mean, no, I mean,
but they were at rest
before he was major as colonel, right? Colonel,
lieutenant, captain, colonel. But yeah, Captain Giselle, Colonel West.
Wait, major. Where's Major West?
Major's above.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. You're right.
Right? Or is major? Is it major and then colonel?
I can't remember.
Hang on.
No, because
I got it.
He was Major West first because Major Colum West sounds better than
Colonel
and Colum West.
Colonel West. But Colonel West sounds better than Major West, in my opinion. But
no, with Colum in the middle there.
Right. CC I know. But I'm saying
ECW
like.
ECW doesn't work as well as MCW.
I agree. I'm saying that I like Colonel West more than I like Major West.
Yeah, with excluding his first name, I am with you.
Yes, yeah, but yes, you are right. So the structure goes lieutenant, captain, major, colonel. Their sergeant is somewhere in there.
Yeah, which skipped entirely.
But sergeant's like in a pointy position. I don't know where that lands.
Yeah,
might be above lieutenant. I don't know, but
yeah. And then there's general, and then. Lord Marshall.
Lord Marshall. Yeah. There may be a Marshall title.
We're like well versed in army talk.
For sure. I definitely come from military background, a big military guy.
Super.
Not at all. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to demean it either.
This side of the.
Yeah. on the other hand, I did not intend to demean it by any means. Thank you for your service.
Please let us know if you got it like, entirely wrong.
Well, I think in the series we got it right.
Between the book and like the U.S. military. Let us know.
I'm sure.
Call in at 1-2-9-10-408-2534.
Hang tight. Hang tight. I got to look up our phone number.
Okay. I think you can text number two.
You can. I had to text it to keep it alive.
If that's more enticing, you can text that phone number instead of leaving us voicemail.
Yeah.
We'll still read it.
Sure.
Maybe we'll share memes back and forth. I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. Also, Instagram. Moments later, after this, we see the state of the fortress from a new set of eyes. This whole time we've been seeing it from Logan and Dognan's perspective, and they see it as bad but serviceable. And West is like, this is so bad. This is despicable. This is like sticks. We can't believe that they survived as long as they had for the 7 days as they had claimed, of course. But then we run in to the gate in an array of hanging named men and Black Dow chatting away with Furious once again, happy to see his old friend and explain the three named men that he's hung up from the gates for all to see and the beautiful picture that it creates.
This is what'd you make of that? I've ever seen Black Dow.
That's not when he was burning bodies on day four, but yes.
Maybe, yeah.
Which is fucked up.
That's fair. Yeah. There's there is a great bit of comedy in this entire section where we understand these men were very clearly like brutally, like they've been brutalized. They've been dead for, they were not hanged to death. They were just corpses that they took and hung.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are trophies hanging.
They were dead before they were hanged.
Good one. Good one.
Oh, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah.
I do like that conversation between Furious, Chief Furious, and Black Dow. West is clearly like sick by like looking at these just swaying, spinning bodies. But Dow, I think, does a really good job of, I don't know what the reason is. I don't know what the custom is, but like they're all named men. They're all like important men in the opposition's army. And I don't know if it's a sign of respect or disrespect, but it is an elevated position for this, for these notable opponents to be in death.
Yeah, it's kind of like claiming that you've beaten the most intimidating of your enemies, right? So it's like you've claimed the wanted posters in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, very much.
And here they are.
So probably more of a sign of trophies. It's both. It's both respect and disrespect.
It's infamy, right? Like it's
infamy is the better way to put it.
Well, exactly. Like depending on the side, right? And again, either way, these are corpses blowing in the wind that are nameless to the Union and are so important by comparison to the Northmen.
Yeah, exactly.
We then turn to Dogman's perspective shortly thereafter, getting good and drunk, of whom is real glad that Furious and the Union made it after all the while abruptly mentioning the death of Tol Duru as though it's like, oh, hey, also, I sneezed yesterday. Yeah. Same timbre.
I don't know what to think of it. I think it's...
Dogman's drinking, so cheers.
Cheers. It's in line with, I guess, what I would expect from Dogman and like most of the Northmen. But at the same time, he's treating it so impersonal compared to what I would have assumed.
I think he's drinking to numb it. Right? I think like that's probably that's right entirely read on it.
But I feel like if that was the case, maybe he wouldn't bring it up so readily and so casually. But
yeah, it's just the I don't state know
of drunk that he's in. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to. I feel like I'm too far reading into it, and that's probably.
I get it. I get it. I understand exactly where you're coming from. I think that personally, I relate the most of all of the characters to Dogman. And that's a weird statement to make. He's a brutal Northman. He's got like a weird nose on him. I've got a weird nose on me, so that makes sense. But like the rest of it, very odd, Crossland. It is his... For me, the reason that I like Dogman and the reason that I relate to Dogman the most is that I think that the way that he approaches... people and situations I'm a kindred spirit with. A number of years ago, I had a close cousin pass away very suddenly. And how did I broach it? I didn't talk about it all day. We got drunk at a winery and I went, I have to go to Wyoming tomorrow. My cousin died. And you were like, what? And then I knocked over a heat lamp, right? So like, that's just the sort of kindred spirit. I see myself in Dogman pretty readily. And I understand that there are certain things that we have a tough time grappling with. Sometimes it only comes out in certain ways. That's not to say that alcohol is the cause or the solution to those problems. And it shouldn't be for a lot of people. You definitely get a better handle on it than that. I've gotten a better handle on it over the years than that. That was at like,
that was
22.
A long time ago.
That
was
22 or 23. Ago? Yeah. That was what?
That was. I was in college in Winona.
Yeah, I was 23, I think, when that happened.
I was in Winona.
22? We could legally drink. Yeah.
No.
I mean, we were at a winery.
I was 22 until I was home. I was 21 my senior
year. Well, yeah, but you're fucking young, dude.
Oh, that's true. But, yeah, it was probably. Yeah,
I think I was 23. Anyway, yeah. Core point being.
Whatever.
Core point being.
Point's the same.
Young. I still kind of behave that way from time to time. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not commendable. It just is the way that it is.
Yeah. But
I relate to Dogman. I understand where it's coming from.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, you have to deal with things like that in whatever way you're physically capable in dealing with it. And there are better ways to do things. But that's not helpful when you're in the moment. And I don't know, hopefully I was there enough for you in the moment, but
oh yeah. I wouldn't say I wasn't reading into the immediacy of that. No, what I no, do want
just in general, like, be there for your friends when they're going through tough times, and also understand that people go through tough times in many, many different ways.
Right. Yeah. Everyone processes things very differently. The thing I wanted to say here, too, to lend a little bit back to Dogman in his own right, is he's suddenly been thrust into a role of leader, right? That's so the other too. Side of this is, like, my choice that I made to do this led to that death. I have to be okay with it. And there's some of that, too, that's, like, weighing on him naturally, I think. He's too drunk to, like, get into his internal monologue a little bit more, but, you know, I think that we can read that from our understanding of Dogman as a person.
Yeah, I think so, too. You're right.
Bethod, of course, you mentioned earlier there was, like, a little footnote, of course. Both the Witch, the Feared, and Bethod have all made their escape away from here in the immediate moment.
Mm-hmm.
The bastards.
The bastards. The motherfuckers. I'm not surprised. This isn't that footnote that I was talking about, though.
Oh, really? I thought that this was going to be the footnote.
No, the footnote I'm talking about is where West mentions that he and the Union Army slaughtered 5,000 flatheads.
Oh, fair. Yeah, on their way. They caught him. Right. Right. Because that's what the other force, not Polder, Croy's force, undoubtedly caught the flatheads, and they saw that, right? As they were fleeing, retreating.
I thought it was like West and his force.
West also did as they like made their way up the hill. That's why they were so delayed.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
But yeah, I thought it was a combination. Like there was some catch flank and there was some of them, but yeah, they do kill a ton of flatheads. In addition to me, what that calls out is that Bethod and the Witch made it and the Feared made it away. So like, did some of the Shanka make it away?
Probably.
You know?
I'd assume.
Given Cowrib's, you know, control of them, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
presumably.
Could be what tipped them off to this being a multi-pronged assault, which is why they backed off in the first place.
Yeah, that's my takeaway, is this went on long enough that they were able to really assess what was going on, and they mm-hmm. were able to view the Union Army. Like, look in on them and see what was going on and make their escape because of the delay.
That feels like what happened. I would agree. Okay, so then we move into Logan's perspective and the funeral of Tel'Duru and sort of the pressure of the moment. Everyone's staring at him as though he did it. He doesn't know that he did, but he assumes that he did, given sort of the blackout. And it's a sad moment by a lot of means, but there's this additional level of like alien that is felt on behalf of Logan.
So I didn't get the feeling that everyone was blaming him. I felt like it was all on him. Like he felt like he was alienating himself because he assumed that he did this. I'd have to go back and like really specifically look in on that.
I think it's in particular, even so, all around Logan, there was a gap, an empty space, a man wide, that space he used to have around him in the old days where no one would dare to stand.
I took that as that's just him in battle and he's re-engaged that part of him. But I didn't get any indication that people were, and maybe I should have read more into that note, but I didn't get the indication that people were blaming him and knew that he killed Tull.
Yeah, I think that it's not no, but it's an understand that he was involved, right? Like, it's not...
Okay.
No one witnessed it, but they understand what happens around the Bloody Nine, they understand where he was, and there's like this offhanded blame. And I think Logan does internalize a lot of that, but I think he's also kind of skittered around from other perspectives. I think there's enough to insinuate that they question it, but and people wanted to kind of be closer to him and around him before, but now they're giving him this man of distance.
Okay.
That's what I'm viewing it as, because they were sitting together. There's a lot of closeness, especially with Tull. Tull was the guy who was like, you're good. We're friends. We know this. I'm happy to have you back. And without Tull now, you know, He was maybe the guy who was just breaching that distance. He might have been the only one. And that could also be the read from Logan's perspective, right? Like, there was just this one guy who, like, crossed that barrier more than anyone else. So no one steps up immediately to do the eulogy. But then Black Dow steps up, of whom, you know, we've seen the two of them fight over the course of all of these novels. They've constantly been at odds with each other. They've hit each other. They've wrestled. They've been bickering in different ways. Black Dow's talked about killing Tull a couple of times. But in my opinion, he delivers the best eulogy of the series thus far, saying, "Tull Duru Thunderhead, back to the mud. The dead know we didn't always see things the same way, me and him. Didn't often agree on nothing, but maybe that was my fault, as I'm a contrary bastard at the best of times. I regret it now, I reckon. Now it's too late. Tull Duru. Every man in the North knew his name, and every man said it with respect, even his enemies. He was the sort of man that gave you hope. You want strength, do you? You want courage? You want things done right and proper the old way? There you go. Tull Duru Thunderhead. Look no fucking further. I'm less now that he's gone, and so are all of you." Dogman mutters, "We are all less."
Yeah. It's such a great speech, and like that ending of "I'm less now that he's gone" is beautiful, simple writing.
Hold him accountable, perfect. You know?
Yeah. So well done. I want to ask, have we had a funeral without Black Dow giving a eulogy?
Hard and Grim did Three Trees.
It was Hard and Grim that did Three Trees.
Didn't Dogman do... No, Three Trees did Foley, the weakest.
Okay. For some reason, I thought it was always like...
He generally like has a line.
It's always Black Dow.
But I think it's always a snide comment. It's not like... It's always been snide.
He does speak a lot at funerals.
Yeah. But this is the first time he's spoken at a funeral.
Okay.
This is the first time he's given like the eulogy. Because he always has like something snide to say. And instead, this is nothing but genuine, unfiltered man.
Yeah.
And it's so good. It's so strong and powerful. And it speaks to the way that Tull Duru moved everyone. He was a great character throughout this entire story. Again, I understand that people may not and may just see like the Northmen as like a clump of people. I've always been able to differentiate those. Again, I attribute that to like the Minnesotan in me, because it is sort of that like northern, like hardier vibe. And they each have very, in my opinion, distinct characteristics. But cheers to Thunderhead, my favorite of the dead Northmen thus far. Totally.
My favorite of all of the Northmen that are alive.
Fair enough.
Yes, it's partially because he's big like me.
He is big like you. Yeah. He is the big fucker among big fuckers, right? The giant's dark glinting sword among the rest.
We got to stick together.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's kinship there.
And like, the "I'm less now that he's gone."
It's
just
so good.
Like,
it's so simple. Mm-hmm. It's so good. I don't know if it's co-opted from anything. I don't know if it exists anywhere else, but this is first experience with that phraseology, and it really, really stuck with me.
It cuts deep. It's a lot. It makes me very sad. It makes me deeply sad for a fictional character. In ways, again, the eulogy that Joe wields is so much better than... This is just like a minor thing about writing in general and like people writing deaths. And I'm taking this in as my own note. But like, the death scene is good and can like be impactful, and like last words can mean something. But what actually matters from a character's perspective is the parting words that other characters say about them, right? Yeah. That's what leaves us with these feelings one way or another about them. The way that Glockter reflects on Visbrook, right? Is like, this was this unfortunate hero that had to stand, that shouldn't have had to do that. Like, that's a sad thing to reflect on versus whatever his last words were, right? Tull Duru, you know, his last word, you know, being like, "All right, let's get you up," you know, is not the same as this speech and what that means because of the way that it impacts everyone else.
We make a lot of comparisons between this series and Red Rising. I feel like this is the one thing that feels like didn't get translated so well. I feel like Joe does eulogies so much stronger than anything that we see in the Red Rising series.
Yeah, Pierce gives a lot of attention in, and I don't mean this in any sort of like super negative way, but like there's the cliched write up the character before they die, like give them all the moments before they die so that you can see it all. And like you get the full breadth of the character. Joe, meanwhile, is like, that's not the way that life works, and gives you the way that life works instead.
And I do feel like Tull got a much bigger spotlight this book than the previous two. But my point was, Pierce does a really great job of characters thinking about characters that died after the fact. Mm-hmm. But that's not the same as actual eulogies.
Right. Fair. Yeah. That's fair. There's a lot of reflection on characters. Don't want to be spoilerific by any stretch, but yeah.
No.
I was thinking of a couple of examples, and I was like, maybe I don't dive into this just for people's sake. Mm-hmm. But read the Red Rising series if you haven't. And if you stop the Red Rising, read Golden Sun upon my singular recommendation. Our singular recommendation.
Mm-hmm. I've got
you should.
Kaylin's mom listening to all the audiobooks right now.
Cool. That's good. Yeah. Nice. Very cool.
Jill, if you're listening all right. to this. Hi.
Okay. So after the beautiful eulogy that is just so well done, all these men standing around, West, Pike, Shivers, Grimm, everyone's kind of breaking down, broken up because they've lost someone of whom was a deep friend to a lot of them. I mean, Pike maybe being the rogue exception among them, you know, like welcomed into the Northmen, but he did trek with them. So, you know, undoubtedly he thought of him as a friend through the cold, through the forest and everything else. So we end the chapter with Logan's internal reflection on the high places growing dark and sort of the way that he feels less than nothing, wishing that it was possible for him to weep, knowing in his heart of hearts the violence that he's caused. He's wrestling with this identity and his mythology, like we've talked about before, and whether or not he can escape it or outrun it or go in a different direction, even in a big way. So the chapter ends with this wonderful bit of prose. He says, if you want to be a new man, you have to stay in new places and do new things with people who never knew you before. If you go back to the same old ways, what else can you be but the same old person? You have to be realistic. He'd played at being a different man, but it had all been lies. The hardest kind to see through. The kind you tell yourself. He was the Bloody Nine. That was the fact. And however he twisted and squirmed and wished to be someone else, there was no escaping it. Logan wanted to care, but the Bloody Nine cares for nothing.
This is a real, real tough one. I get it, given that he's soaking in the aftermath of everything that has transpired. It's hard to see him resigning to the idea that this is how it always will be, and also resigning to the fact that the Bloody Nine dictates who he is. Like, I feel like it's pretty clear that these are two fairly segregated personalities, and he's allowing that personality to stop the conscious personality from growth. From growing, from changing, from bettering itself. And it's hard to grapple with. It's hard to even understand as somebody who doesn't deal with an internal unconscious personality. So I don't quite know how to approach all of this, but I know it really, really sucks and is hard to read.
It's a hard thing to grapple with because there is, like you said, this nature of this unconscious personality that's beneath it all. But then on top of that, there's this other side that's like, this just is who I am at the same time. And I kind of have to accept that. Like,
yeah, there's a nature versus nurture argument in all of this. Mm-hmm.
on
right.
very heavily on the, I guess it would be on the nature side.
This is his nature, and he can't get himself, you can't betray your nature is sort of the takeaway in my mind,
yeah.
right? Like, you can try all you will to, like, nurture yourself out of it, but unless you truly remove yourself from any situation in which you have ever been found before, that is your only opportunity potentially to flee who you are, right? Yeah, I think it's kind of Logan's core point here. That's truly, his thesis, is you have to venture forth.
Only way.
Yeah. That's a tough reality to face as a Logan in the world, you know?
But also doesn't seem inaccurate given the evidence.
It's not. Just a minor note, and you know, it's we've never drawn this comparison, and I've avoided it for many reasons, but you know, Logan the Berserker Northman, Logan the Canadian Wolverine Berserker. Did you think about that a little bit?
A little bit.
Yeah, for Crombie, before you like, because like, dude, they're, you spelt it differently, but it's pretty much the same.
If
you
think close. About it.
It's pretty close.
Pretty close.
Both from the cold, frigid north.
I would be curious, yeah. if, like, what sort of comic book fan?
It's not. No. I mean, he is a varied comic book fan, not like a big one by any stretch. Obviously, he read comic books. I've listened to a lot of Joe Abercrombie interviews. This is the only reason I feel opinionated to speak on it. But he did not model it after Logan by any stretch. He read comics growing up, but he was not like a fan. If I remember correctly, he really enjoyed Green Lantern books, if I remember correctly, like early Green Lantern, more of like an early DC guy, a lot of Batman, a lot of Superman, and then kind of like out of it for the most part, a little bit of X-Men, but not too much. So
okay,
again, way in my mind, way more of a D&D influence on Logan as a character than anything else. I think that, like, truly that's where his character influence comes from. Although, now that you're this deep in, do you think it's as simple as the barbarian class archetype?
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
He's not just a barbarian. Well, he's so much more.
As a character, no, but as a fighter, yeah.
Well, fine. As a combat, like, as a full character, though.
That's all of D&D characters. Like, the class is combat almost entirely.
Fine. It's not, because it informs, like, the rest of your skills and abilities, but I understand. I understand what you're saying, but yeah, which then informs what you can do. It's cool. All right. Okay. Fine. I will leave your answer where it is, because you're in your own right to have that opinion. All right. With that, we'll get into our last chapter of the week, Rude Awakenings. We return to the fallout of our wedding and the battlefield that is shared. Rather, that is the shared bedroom of Jizal and Queen Therese of Talons, and Jizal's immediate
is
regret for his
her title.
Well, I, she's of
Queen
Talons
Therese of the Union now.
Yeah, but like, is she the Union? I don't know.
Should be.
She's also the Princess of Talons. I mean, there's no
she's
debate
not.
That she
nope.
would.
Title's changed.
Title edition.
Ownership
elevated. All right. So, did you say ownership? Jesus. I mean, I get it. You're not wrong, especially
it's,
in the way that she
way
presents
that
it
presented.
And the way that
it's
society
the way that
presents
it's
it.
Set up. It
yeah,
sucks.
Right.
It's wrong, but that's the fact
that
it
technically.
Feels like.
Yeah. Yeah. I do want to just say on the front of this, I do think that titles generally work in the realm of the superior title goes first. So, okay, to that point, Queen Therese of the Union, Princess of Talons, Lord of the Queen Four-Pillared Bedroom, like, is that, or Four-Banistered Bed, like, is that the Princess Bed? I don't know, because those are princess beds, right, with the four pillars and then the, like, drapes around? I think that's what they're called, but.
I've heard them called that, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, she's the Princess of Talons, you're right, she's the Queen of the Union by proper titles. But yeah, there's an immediate regret from Jizal for his decisions and actions. Although, again, he says it like it was his decision. It was not his decision, although it kind of was, by not making a decision and not asserting himself in some way, shape, or form. Although, can you really supersede the will of Baez? I don't think so.
Probably not.
You know, there's a lot there.
Once.
Yeah. While searching for greener grass, the king has been fully scorned in his own room, and Abercrombie's description of it is just delicious, coming from the soldier who has never really experienced war. Like, it is yeah. So
it's
facile.
Dripping with amazing metaphors. It's mm-hmm. The whole scene is great. What an upsetting scenario for our boy to find himself in.
Yeah. Yeah, it is just really sad in so many rights. I mean, there's this like reflection in the moment too on like one of the princess's handlers kind of like looking down at him in different moments and people and sort of the front that she puts on in front of everyone. You know, it's just sort of a lot, and Giselle is not having a good time by any stretch. His life has become hell.
By just because he's guilty of being a bastard.
Just because he's a bastard. It is that ugly nepo bigotism.
That's why I feel semi-okay with, like, kind of jabbing towards Therese in this moment, because, like, this is all driven off of bigotry.
Right, and it's the same thing that we were jabbing at Giselle for this whole time, right? Sure. Like, we've been making the same comments. This is just a step above, and now he's getting his just desserts, like we were saying earlier. Like, this is... Sure. This is nothing but what he deserved.
But also,
it sucks.
Forced marriages in general.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. An arranged marriage like this was good for no one, particularly no one.
Particularly Therese. Like, she's truly not. She is truly a victim in this.
Oh, very true. Yeah. I mean, she could have a loving relationship, I'm sure, or marriage to someone else, you know, instead. But here she is, Therese. Literally anybody.
Somebody pure blooded. Somebody with good blood.
Caspa! kid. So our time in this part with our king comes to an end with a knock at the door, Therese kind of shouting, and they're being like, I'm just going to the door, let me cross the battle line, basically, to answering the door and it being Gorst. With his high-pitched voice coming and informing Giselle that the Gurkish have invaded Mitterland.
The Gurkish are coming! The Gurkish are coming!
It's so funny, because truly, outside of the Gurkish are coming! The Gurkish are coming! How common is that phraseology? It can't be widespread outside the United States. No one fucking knows about Paul Revere if you didn't live here. You know what I mean? Like,
no one knows. Probably not. That's probably a pretty
unless you're pretty like American. A student of history and like for some reason you're studying American history.
But even like I wonder if like English scholars like. Not like deep scholars, but like casual English scholars of the American Revolution. I wonder how prevalent the story of Paul Revere is.
Yeah. Also, the story of Paul Revere is more of a myth because it wasn't even fully him, which is another like funny element of it all. But yeah. Yeah. Because it was there was a dentist, right? Wasn't I forget the guy's name off the top of my head, but it was a dentist, I believe, that was or a doctor. Remember. That was the first that actually like left, made the call. Then it was handed up the line, eventually arrived at Paul, and Paul did like one ride to get it to the final point or something like that. Anyway, I digress. Point is, it's more of a myth than a reality. There's a realness to it, but it's more, it's been mythologized.
As we know in this story, myths are
the bloody nine. Yeah, right. So from this moment of the Gurkish invasion being declared, we then move to Pharaoh for the first time this week. Wielding a table leg in her sleep, sleeping on the ground in the house that she's sleeping with Baez. I found this whole thing so funny. She's clearly sleeping on the ground. I'm not sure if she grabbed the table leg before she fell asleep or she broke it off while laying on the ground. Unclear. What was your read? Like, she freaked out because of the noise and then broke the table leg off? That was a take? Did she just have it?
My headcanon of it, which wasn't like super set in stone, but sometime in the night she was sleeping there, felt unarmed and like broke off a table leg.
That tracks. That's kind of what I was thinking too. Like that was like, yeah, at some point she cuddled up with a table leg and then broke it off because she was afraid of noises. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get it. I agree. But she's awoken by a conversation between Yulwei, of whom is returned, and Bias discussing the pending Gurkish invasion that we just heard about from Gorst. There's a lot of different details that are shared, but among them, Kalul isn't joining them, of course. He's sending the 100 words and his man, Uthman, or not Uthman al-Dash, but Mamun. We have the 100 words, of course, arriving with them. Uthman al-Dash has sanctified this as sort of the holy victory and the glory that they're seeking.
All of and the titles Yulwei, that Mamun calls himself,
yes.
Bias cuts Yulwei off. And
Bias is so mad about Mamun. The first of the Magi being mad at the apprentice. Yeah. It's interesting because upon reflection, even thinking about the apprentices that Bias has, right? Like we have Yoru Sulfur, right? And Yoru doesn't have any fucking names that he goes by. Like he's no one else.
We know.
He doesn't have any. Well, yeah, I just mean he doesn't have any like crazy like titles in the moment that we're aware of. So, you know, it is ego and posturing, and he views that as effacious because his whole their leadership dictums are entirely separate, right? Bias rules from the shadows, and Kalul
hasn't allowed anybody legit to rise to any sort of autonomy below him.
Versus Kalul is the prophet of whom is up front with everyone, and like everyone knows, and has raised this army of eaters of whom broke the first law. But there's also a reflection on the seed and how Yulwei is actually happy that he didn't find the seed on that quest, because the results could have graver consequences if he did, because of the sort of tearing down of the walls between the other side, that damaged portal that he believes could be open still within Alcus. But then in addition, like his view on death and like the loss of this is so much more grounded than Baez's. Baez views this sort of like revenge as this sort of extreme, like negative, I have to fight against this, versus Yulwei's like, no, breaking the first law and like doing that is way worse than just a lot of people dying.
Right.
Humanity continues.
Exactly. And I mean, Yulwei parrots the same view of all of the other Magi that we see during Baez's quest. None of them, like all of them actively tell him not to seek the seed. So, yeah, it makes sense that he'd be openly relieved that it wasn't found.
Of course. So, Pharaoh then breaks in, having listened at the door, and is presented with the fact that the Gurkish are coming and that she is ready for war to extract her revenge in some fashion on the thousands of Gurkish that are knocking down, beating down, hammering down the walls.
Again, man. I love that she kicks the door in. Like, she breaks the lock with her, like, just karate kicks it open. Her hearing's so fucking good. It's great. I love it.
Yeah, it's definitely really great.
It's not just her benefit, it's our benefit, because we wouldn't hear this unfiltered conversation between Bias and Yulwei without it. Like this is an audience plot delivery device through the story,
right,
of Pharaoh's super hearing.
Yeah, it gives us perspective that otherwise we wouldn't have, and then also informs us that she is incredibly capable, you know, in her own right too, which is
for sure
just nice.
Yeah, it is.
Cool. As a final kind of note here, did you have anything else on the perspective as we end the part?
Chains and drums, man. Chains and
drums. Chains and drums. PJ, I'm going to take just a moment here to open up the final part of this novel to talk about the beginning, the first line of part two. I'm sure you heard it on accident as the chapter ended at some point. No, you didn't. Well, if you haven't, the quote that begins this is one that I've already told you, explained in prior, but the last argument of kings is our opening of quote, dash, inscribed on the canons of Louis the 14th.
Right.
And so it begins. The war, the combat, the finale. Here we are. Now we're here, PJ. This trilogy, this book, the climax, because all this is really just one novel, as a casual reminder. Here we are. We're at the Return of the King moment. It all comes down to this.
Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah, dude. I haven't asked this in a long time. A long time. It's been a while. I would love if there are any predictions that are percolating in your mind.
Ooh. Other than what I've already like solidified as.
Right, right. You've got some like good guesses on like people being representative of, yeah.
Did one of my guesses, something I talked about early on in this episode, that get solidified in, as an actual bet?
I don't think you made a bet.
I think it was, something to do with the Duke being absent, or not being absent. I think.
Oh, Duke Orso.
Yeah, I think Styria is going to mount an attack on the Union, with Therese being an inside informant for them. I don't think we get any more Northmen deaths this book. Maybe Dogman. Do I think Dogman dies this book? Yeah. Dogman dies this book.
All right.
Polder dies and Croy legitimately becomes West's right-hand man alongside Pike.
Polder dies? That's what you said?
One of Croy and Polder die and the other becomes like the legitimate
one of the duo of generals dies. One becomes a legit general.
I think Jizal dies and the realm is thrust into leadership chaos.
Okay.
I don't
dies. Realm thrown into chaos.
Am I going to officially ship Glockta and Artie? Yes.
Okay.
I think a romance starts budding between the two of them. I don't know if it should, but I think it does. And Carlet, Dan, Ida. No, I've already mentioned. I think she's the eater. Those are my guesses. I think that's a good number of guesses for the next part of the book.
All right. I dig it. Cool. I just want to take some down because like this is our final sort of junction for most of the story.
Do we
until
have
this trilogy
to
comes
off.
To an end?
I feel like there was one. I feel like there was something that you wanted me to pay off last episode that we didn't.
There was a little bit of the author in the war, and like I kind of was thinking about the four companions and like whether or not that sticks. But I think I want to pay that off all at once in sort of the comparisons. So
okay,
yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah, we added the Carlot thing last week, which was the only other one that I can think of. But cool. All right. So that ends this week on the whole. Thank you guys so much, of course, for listening. Next week, we're going to be reading The Number of Dead Through Leadership. The Number of Dead Through Leadership. Please, again, let us know what you guys are thinking of the pacing here. Next week is more typical, more prototypical of our usual weeks. This one was a shorter week, but we ran a little bit long for a short week, which is fine. Of course, you know, hope on the whole that you really enjoyed it. Other than that, thank you so much to everyone, of course, who's listening to this. I want to particularly thank all of our patrons, and of course we have a new patron this week, Tate Boehm, of whom joined us as a bartender. Thank you so much for supporting us.
Hi, Tate. Late.
It's a really big deal. Glad to have you. Hope you appreciate all the content and everything else that we put out. Other than that, you can definitely give us
Discord yet. If you want to join the Discord, you can.
Yeah, join the Discord. We've a fun time there.
You don't know how to. We will help you.
Yes. Yeah, send us a message because we can definitely help out. I've been notably absent. That's partially because work's been absolutely insane. I had a crazy set of travel days. We'll talk about it more in a double cut in the upcoming future. PJ also was
Iowa. Work's been intense for both of us.
Yeah, it hit at the same time, too, which has led to both of us being absent, which is weird and atypical. But nonetheless, we hope that everyone is having a great time. We're super excited. and can't wait for more. If you want to follow us, please check us out on social media. You can find us Words Whiskey Pod on Instagram and Threads predominantly. That's pretty much where we are for the most part. We share more on stories than anything else. I've been threading a little bit more here and there, but not too much. We'll get back to it. We've got kind of like a fun series that we've planned of posts. So look out for some like cocktail book combos with maybe a little bit of a musical inspiration. Yep. Some fun ones coming up that we're very excited about. So yeah, PJ got the matches record. Fuck, I forgot to pick that up. It's in my mailbox. I got to get it for my brother and whatnot out of my mailbox. But yeah, so very, very, very excited about many and much more to come there. Like PJ mentioned earlier, you can call us 910-408-2534 if you want to leave us a voicemail or shoot us a text message.
Shoot us a text message. That's lower pressure, yeah. lower intensity. You can proofread it before you send it, unlike voicemails. I understand. I get it. But I had that epiphany today that like, oh, people could text that too.
Yeah, I watched Beef this week, and one of the main characters had a voicemail. Did you watch Beef?
Beef is so good.
So fucking good. Oh my god.
Like, I haven't watched it in like a year or whatever.
So good. I'm like behind on a lot of the things that I think a lot of people binged over the last year. So I've been doing Squid Game very slowly, and then I did
Beef. I've never seen, I should do that.
Oh, it's super good. Definitely watch it in subtitles. Don't watch it dubbed, which means that you're going to be the only one that watches it, but do it. Worth it. So good. Definitely worth it. It's incredible. And I get why it became a sensation and a phenomenon. It's incredible. I can't believe that people watch the dub version personally. I'm glad that people were exposed to it via the dub version. That's also cool. But the sub is so much better. The acting is just incredible. I can't. Too good. Anyway, reeling it back in for just a brief moment. Text us, like the character in the Beef of whom says, leaving voicemails for old people. So just shoot us a text message instead. That was the whole core point of that entire thing.
910-408-2534.
Yeah, yeah.
You could also, if you're so inclined, you could leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. I think Spotify allows.
Yeah.
They didn't for a while, but they do now. So you could do that. Leave a 5-star review. And if you don't leave a 5-star review, we will make fun of you as you get married to somebody that you don't actually love.
I was going to say hang you in the gates of a derelict fortress, but I prefer the marriage thing. Yeah, that's more realistic. A good call.
Yeah, that's a little less aggressive.
All right.
We'll still laugh at you either way.
Yeah, either way. Cool. With that, we'll see you next week.
See you then.
Bye.